Hello, I'm Rhea Blakey for Discovery Health. Our topic today is optimizing care for pelvic health problems. I'd like to thank the University of Virginia School of Medicine for accrediting the program. I'd also like to thank Ethicon Women's Health and Urology for providing the educational grant to make this program possible. I'd like to remind physicians and other healthcare professionals that you can earn CME credit by registering online at discoveryhealthcme.com and taking the post-test. All the slides, references, and graphics from today's program will also be available online. It's easy to log on, take the post-test, and earn free credit for the program, so do it today. Now, we're fortunate to have a distinguished group of experts in our studios today to talk about issues relating to pelvic health. Dr. Vivian Connor, co-director, Section of Minimally Invasive Gynecology, Cleveland Clinic, Florida, in Weston, Florida. Dr. Dennis Miller, medical director, Milwaukee Urogynecology, Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And Dr. Barbara Levy, medical director, Women's Health and Breast Center, Franciscan Health System, Federal Way, Washington. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Pelvic health problems affect more than 35 million women in the U.S., yet these common problems, including abnormal menstrual bleeding, pelvic organ prolapse, or POP, and stress urinary incontinence, remain underdiagnosed and undertreated. Although some physicians believe these conditions to be benign, they can have serious effects on a woman's quality of life. It's important for clinicians to learn more about diagnosis as well as some of the current treatment options available. During the next hour, we'll review the following: the epidemiology of pelvic health problems in women, focusing on menorrhagia, fibroids, pelvic organ prolapse, and stress urinary incontinence, the adverse physical and psychological effects of these conditions, strategies to screen for pelvic health problems in women who present for routine exams, office-based evaluations for SUI, POP, fibroids, and menorrhagia, and surgical and non-surgical options available for treatment. Now, menorrhagia, fibroids, stress urinary incontinence, and pelvic organ prolapse are common problems for women that affect them at different stages in their lives. Dr. Connor, how many women are affected by these pelvic health issues?
Well, these are very, very common, undertreated and underdiagnosed problems. Menorrhagia or heavy menstrual bleeding affects approximately 5% of women per year who seek treatment based on insurance claims.
We know that over 40% of women by the time we reach age 40 will have fibroids. We know that they're more common in women of color than Caucasian women. But the truth is, what matters is what's symptomatic with respect to the fibroids, not whether they're there or not there, but whether they cause symptoms and heavy bleeding.
This whole continuum of asymptomatic to symptomatic makes population study really difficult to do.
Well, let's start with menorrhagia. For a long time, menorrhagia had been defined as a certain amount of blood loss during a woman's cycle. Dr. Connor, how useful is that particular definition?
Well, not particularly useful, Rhea. The classic definition of menorrhagia is if a woman is losing more than 80 ml of blood per menstrual cycle. And that comes from a study done in Sweden in 1966 where they looked at menstrual flow in women, and it was thought that women who lost more than 60 to 80 ml of blood per menstrual cycle were more likely to become anemic. So this became just a statistical cutoff. Today in the United States, our diets are different than they were then. Our reproductive lifestyles are different. So this particular definition may not actually be pertinent anymore.
What's most critical is the disruption in a woman's life. She's having to change clothes at work. She's having to leave the theater or her friend's house with blood stains. It's very embarrassing. It's disruptive to quality of life. And that's really when we need to intervene and help her. Women will come in anemic. And when asked, she will say, well, my period's normal. It's the way it's always been. And when really we get down into the questioning, what we find is that she has always had much heavier than average periods. But to her, they are normal.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, heavy menstrual bleeding is the most common cause of iron deficiency anemia in reproductive age women. And I think that's very important for general practitioners and family practitioners to recognize when these young women come to their offices, rather than sending them for colonoscopy or to a hematologist to have their anemia evaluated. They should be asking them, what are your menstrual cycles like? And if they were to say normal, that's not enough of an answer.
The history questions I usually use to help me distinguish is how much pad tampon use is going on. So are they needing to use double protection? And then how often are those being soaked? Now, I don't ask how often they change, because some women will change with just a little drop, or they'll change every time they go to the bathroom, but they may not be soaked. And then the second issue is, do they soak their clothing? Do they soak the bed at night? What is their typical period? A classic is, I have to put towels in the bed. If she's putting towels in the bed, there's something not right.
Dr. Levy, what's the appropriate workup for women with menorrhagia?
So there are hormonal causes of abnormal bleeding, women who don't ovulate. There are structural reasons like the fibroids or endometrial polyps. And then there are systemic illnesses that may cause abnormal bleeding. So in my mind, as I'm talking to a patient, I try to distinguish those things. Women who have predictable menses, their periods are predictable. They don't have to be the same length every month, but they have to occur around once a month. That tells us that basically hormones are normal. And in fact, it's worthless to do a whole lot of hormonal testing if the history tells us that she's bleeding on a regular basis. So that's number one, is just taking a good history to rule out hormonal things. There are some simple blood tests to do, certainly check for anemia. Things like thyroid disease. Women who are hypo or hyperthyroid will develop irregularities in their periods, and those are important things. Once we've ruled those things out, and I think the third thing we really need to think about, certainly in young women, is do they have a bleeding abnormality? And that's something we need to consider in our history taking. We can usually rule that out in the history taking, but not always. And then we need to think about structural things. Viv, how do you do that?
Well, once you've taken your thorough history in the office, then you want to go ahead and do a pelvic exam and try to assess the size of the uterus, perhaps for the presence of fibroids. But if there is a structural abnormality along the endometrium or lining of the uterus, such as a polyp or a submucosal fibroid distorting the endometrium, those things will not be picked up on a pelvic exam. So generally, you need to do some type of imaging. I find one of the best and easiest things to do for that is a pelvic ultrasound. It's very good at picking up these abnormalities, and generally more sophisticated tests such as CAT scans and MRIs are not necessary.
One of the things we have to watch out for, though, with studies is the presence of an anatomic abnormality is not equivalent to the cause of the bleeding. And we know that anatomic abnormalities actually represent a relatively smaller percentage of patients' menorrhagia. One quick guide that I have, a very clinical one, is what has been their history of response to therapy. If they've been given therapy and they're failing therapy, that's a better guide that they'll have an anatomic abnormality. And we shouldn't just continue to persist at treatments that aren't working.
Well, we do know that hysterectomy is often performed for menorrhagia, but there are other effective treatment options. What are some of those other options? Dr. Levy?
Well, you know, if the underlying cause is found, then we should focus on that cause. So if her hormones are out of balance, if she's anovulatory, then we should try to rebalance the hormones. I mean, again, my brain is simple. If you've got a hormonal problem, fix the hormones. We can do that usually medically with progesterone or with birth control pills. But really, the first thing is identify the cause and then begin to work on that cause. Having said that, sometimes it's a lot easier just to give some progesterone or birth control pills because it's the cheapest, easiest way to go. And see if it works, and give it one or two cycles. And if it's not working, then proceed with other things.
And don't you find the combination hormone pills, like birth control pills, are the most commonly used versus progesterone, and you reserve progesterone more often for patients that you'd rather not give the pill to, or no?
You know, it depends on the circumstances. If somebody comes in and she's had a single cycle that's very heavy and prolonged, then I'll try to just resynchronize the endometrium with a burst of progesterone. If she needs contraception anyway, and this is a longer-term issue, then I would Mm-hmm. Work towards using oral contraceptives or contraceptive steroids.
But you don't need to necessarily use hormonal management, too. For women with menorrhagia, the very common non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are effective in about 50% of women for decreasing the inflammation along the endometrium and therefore decreasing the amount of bleeding. So for the woman who is intolerant of a hormonal therapy or reluctant to try it, that's another alternative.
And so you'll often give non-steroidals even in the absence of an accompanying pain with it, without dysmenorrhea, just to treat the menorrhagia.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we forget that a lot.
And then another really simple approach for women who have prolonged episodes of heavy bleeding, in other words, they come in and this is an ongoing problem, we shouldn't forget about the intrauterine progesterone secreting system, the Mirena IUD, which delivers progesterone not systemically but just to the endometrium and to the uterus, is exquisitely effective at controlling abnormal bleeding. Women do have some spotting and bleeding for a few months, but it is magic in terms of controlling bleeding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, we do know that physicians like to learn through case studies, so we had the opportunity to meet with Carrie, one of Dr. Levy's patients, in Lake Taps, Washington, who chose endometrial ablation as her treatment option. Let's see how she arrived at that decision.
I'm an aerobics instructor.
Take it over the top!
I've been an aerobics instructor for probably 6 years now. I teach 11 classes a week. It's a fun job. It doesn't feel like a job at all. I'm 39 years old. I have three kids. I have a 16-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 10-year-old. After I had my son, I had a totally different period. When I was younger, it would start out really slow, and then progressively in the middle of the cycle, it would get a little bit heavier, and then it would die down. This would be really, really heavy for 7 days. I think what caused the problem was childbirth, but I'm not for sure that that was the culprit. I thought maybe it was just temporarily happening, but it just progressively got worse. If I was supposed to start my period on a certain day, I would wear tampons before that, because just in case, you know, you never know exactly when it's going to happen. Sometimes I would get a little crampy, but nothing unbearable that would make me tired. If I was teaching classes, I would use the super tampons and a pad. It was very uncomfortable just because I was nervous about leaking. So if I did, then I would be really embarrassed. Right before class, I would change, and right after class, I would change. I couldn't wear shorts during that week. I had to wear dark clothes. I decided to make an appointment with my doctor. It was my regular yearly exam, and I talked to her about my really heavy periods. There was some choices. There was a prescription that you could use to curb the flow, I guess, and I tried that for a while. It didn't work. Plus, I really don't like to take anything. I don't like to take even aspirin. My doctor suggested this new procedure that they were having. There's a chance that it can either reduce your periods to nothing or you can have lighter periods. So I definitely said, sign me up. I was done having children. I think this procedure, you have to make sure that you are done having children before you have it. It was in her office. I was able to walk out of there. I was totally fine. Didn't have any pain after. I had to take 2 weeks off from my activities. I had to kind of slow it down a little bit until I was fully healed. After the procedure, there's some discharge for a long time, probably about a month. After a couple months, I noticed a difference. My period lasts about 4 days. It's not as heavy as it was. It's not completely gone, but it is manageable. My life has changed to the better just because I don't have to worry about it. I can wear shorts and I can wear light color and still not have to worry about it. There's a big steep hill in our neighborhood and I would not have walked that during that week. I would have avoided that before the surgery and now I can do it and not worry about it. I believe that I have a better quality of life now.
So I offered Terry lots of choices and we tried the non-steroidals for a couple of cycles. They didn't work for her for whatever reason. Again, she had a normal-sized uterus, so we talked about the levonorgestrel intrauterine system. She didn't like the idea of having anything inside of her. She, as you heard her say, didn't really want to do anything in terms of taking long-term medications. So then we were left with talking about either an endometrial ablation or hysterectomy. You can see her lifestyle. You know, time off for hysterectomy was not an option for her at all. And she was really excited about the concept of an endometrial ablation. So we had discussed all of those things in context of her life to come up with endometrial ablation as a choice for her.
There are multiple techniques for endometrial ablation. How do they compare in terms of outcome?
Today, we have five FDA-approved global endometrial ablation devices that use various forms of energy to destroy the endometrium. And these include a hot water balloon system, a freely circulating hot water system, freezing, microwave, and radio frequency generated electricity. We have data from all five of the devices after 1 year for the pivotal trial, data submitted to the FDA. And these show an amenorrhea rate or cessation of menses as a result of the procedure ranging from 22 to 55% after 1 year. And patients are very happy, typically in 96, 90% satisfied with their procedure after 1 year. But because these devices have been available for a period of time now, the first one having been FDA approved in 1997, we do actually have 5 year data for three of the five devices. And overall, 75% of women treated with endometrial ablation for menorrhagia after 5 years are able to avoid a hysterectomy or repeat endometrial ablation.
And even if there's a certain lack of durability of these procedures, what we know is that women are satisfied with improving their periods, even
yes.
if it's without amenorrhea, and even if we get them 5 to 7 years worth of success, they're very satisfied with that. So our definitions often are more strict than clinically patients make their own requirements of success.
Hysterectomy is still an option for women who want definitive treatment. Minimally invasive options are really now the standard. So, Dr. Connor, what are the latest developments for minimally invasive hysterectomy?
Well, I'm actually very excited to offer a minimally invasive approaches to hysterectomy to patients, including laparoscopic or vaginal approaches. These have significantly decreased postoperative pain and a postoperative recovery time when compared with the standard, what I call old-fashioned, open type of hysterectomy. Today, technology is enabling multiple different surgical options. But many women who don't want the less invasive options opt to go right to hysterectomy because it is definitive. These patients are very, very satisfied after these procedures. And the newer, minimally invasive approaches to hysterectomy have really decreased the amount of pain patients experience afterwards and the length of their recovery times.
When menorrhagia has a known underlying cause, you should treat that specifically, address the cause. But what about considerations for women who have menorrhagia with fibroids?
Well, then, if she wants a hysterectomy, and that's what she comes in desiring, we're done. Because she's decided that that's what she wants, and it's clear we just go from there. If what she wants is to preserve her uterus, then we need to do some more investigation. Is the bleeding related to the fibroids or not? So fibroids are benign tumors of the uterus. They're fibrous growths. They, in and of themselves, may or may not be related to bleeding. They can be in one of three locations. They can be inside the lining, so-called submucosal fibroids. They can be in the wall of the uterus, intramural fibroids, which typically at small sizes don't cause bleeding, we don't think. And then they can be on the outside, which are the ones that are very easy to feel, but generally don't cause symptoms much at all. So if she wants preservation of the uterus, then we need to continue to investigate to see, do we really believe that the fibroids that she has are related to her bleeding?
Well, let's switch gears just a little bit. What about women with fibroid tumors that are unrelated to menstrual bleeding? Is there anything that you'd like to add in regards to workup and clinical treatment for those women?
Absolutely, don't. They don't require follow-up. They don't require following ultrasounds to see if they're growing. They don't need anything. If she's not symptomatic and we happen to see a fibroid on an ultrasound or a CT scan, forget it.
The other aspect to fibroid treatment in the absence of menorrhagia is attribution of incorrect symptoms. Primary care providers always have to keep in mind that the presence of fibroids does not necessarily indicate the cause of their symptoms. It's true for urinary symptoms. For years, we've heard patients with urinary complaints, overactive bladder type complaints, where they've been referred because of their fibroids, you know, the uterus pressing on the bladder, of course, which has been shown to not be true. And the most common symptoms a woman can have is pelvic pressure. And we have to be very cautious about attributing pelvic pressure to fibroids, because very often it's not. When you have an anatomic finding like fibroids, it's so incredibly prevalent, you're going to find overlap. There's going to be true and true and not related.